Clerk, please call the first case, and the only case.
Case number 12-2459, People v. Anthony Johnson.
Okay, would the lawyers who are going to argue the case please approach and introduce yourselves.
Stephen Richards on behalf of the appellant, defendant Anthony Johnson.
Good morning, Your Honors. Peter Fisher, an assistant state's attorney on behalf of the people.
Let's proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, Anthony Johnson, and no person is entitled to a perfect trial, but everyone is entitled to a fair trial. Two trials.
You know, before we get into that, is there any evidence here at all that this defendant was involved in this?
Involved in this case?
Mm-hmm.
The evidence is slight and weak.
When you say it's light and weak, what evidence is there? I mean, I'd like to know where it comes from.
Well, first of all, there's two parts to that. All right. First of all, the major evidence came from the witnesses Rufus Johnson and Nolan Swain, both of whom recanted their prior statements at trial. So the jury was faced with a situation where they were saying at trial, we don't know anything, we don't remember anything. The only reason we told things to the police was because we were threatened or hoped we would get a good deal.
But what did their statements say that provided evidence that he was involved?
Okay, as for Rufus Johnson, the only thing was that he said that Rufus Johnson was not present during any of this. He said later, Anthony Johnson said, we busted a move. And that's it. That's all Rufus Johnson contributed. We busted a move. And that statement, as Johnson himself said, was ambiguous. It could mean...
I mean, how is that evidence that he was involved?
I don't think it is. I think it is simply...
So when you say the evidence was weak, are you saying there's no evidence at all, or are you saying it's weak? I mean,
Well, I think it's weak. I mean,
if it's weak, it's enough for the jury to make a finding, isn't there?
Well, I think the jury, under these circumstances, given the errors, was confused and misled on a number of points, both by the failure to instruct and by prosecutorial argument. But continue, there's two points.
But I still haven't heard from you. Where is this evidence that he was involved?
The only evidence is he was in the car. There's some evidence that he drove away. There's some evidence that he was told to follow the car and follow the car. I think that's it. In terms of what his mental state was, whether he knew that this person was armed, whether he knew a murder was going to take place, whether he knew a killing was going to take place, our contention would be there was virtually zero evidence of that. And for that reason, this court held in the first case, the Rule 23, that the evidence was closely balanced for a good reason, because you have two problems here. One problem is the weakness of the witnesses, and the second is everything that is contributed does not establish accountability, certainly beyond reasonable doubt. So with these two problems, the evidence is quite weak. I think the state's position is the evidence is based upon Rufus Johnson's recanted statement, Nolan Swain's recanted statement, and that's about it. In fact, when Anthony Johnson was questioned by the police, by Detective Winstead, he was let go, presumably as a witness and not as a defendant. So the evidence was very weak, and that's why the errors become so significant. Now, let me talk about some of the errors, if I may, in the case. One is a failure...
Well, you keep falling back on the fact that the evidence was weak, and that's why the errors are significant. But I think what Justice Gordon is trying to get you to is your separate argument that you make in your brief that there was a failure to prove the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt.
Okay, as to that...
And that has nothing to do with the errors.
Oh, I understand that.
So I think that's what Justice Gordon is asking you to speak to.
Okay. Well, and what we would say is just in the Phillips case, basically what you have is somebody in the car, driving the car, crime is committed, and there's some evidence, which is contested, that he drives the person away. So it's our argument that this case is on par with Phillips and that there isn't proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, the counter to that is based upon, I think that's basically it. I mean, even if you take Nolan Swain and Rufus Johnson at their word, or as their prior word before they testified, That's what you've got. And it's just the single ambiguous statement, we busted a move, does not establish that either Johnson knew that there was a gun, knew that the person was armed, knew that there was a killing, or helped with the killing before he knew about it. So for those reasons, we would ask that there be a finding of not guilty. Now, if I sufficiently answer those questions, I would like to move on to what the errors would be, assuming the court did find that there was proof beyond reasonable doubt, or that a rational trier of fact could find proof beyond reasonable doubt. One is the failure to give an instruction on what's the Romance Dennis principle, that a murder ends with the killing, with the death, and that things that happen afterwards cannot in and of itself establish criminal liability. And that's a principle that has existed for quite a while, since the Romance Dennis case at least. Now, obviously, it would be a major ruling of this court to hold that this instruction should be given, but it should be given. I'll tell you why. You can see by the arguments in this case that the jury was easily confused on this issue, because there is a fine line between arguing he must have known about it because he drove away, and he's guilty because he drove away. And if you look
well,
at
the first jury was confused. Where is there evidence that this jury was confused?
I think our point is that there is a grave danger of confusion in every case of this sort. And you can tell by
My question is, where is there evidence that this jury was confused?
This jury did not ask questions. So there's not a
So how are they confused?
Well, they're confused because if they listen to the prosecutor's arguments, particularly the arguments where objections were overruled, they could easily conclude that just driving away was sufficient. For example,
isn't that speculation?
I don't think so. I think it's based upon a reasonable inference of what the prosecutor said, what the judge ruled, and what happened when the jury found the defendant guilty. When Prosecutor McCarthy said, you know, you can't just say, I drove there and I drove away, and she said that at one point she argued that's equivalent to a guilty. At points she argued something else. But many of her comments, there was objections overruled. Similarly, the defense sought to, based upon Anthony Johnson's statements, the defense sought to say, listen, if he did drive him away, it was because at that point he knew he was armed and he was afraid of him, which is what Johnson told the police. Prosecutor Valentini said, well, that's the defense the Nazis used at Nuremberg. And that was extremely confusing to the jury because that was an objection overruled, by the way. That was extremely confusing to the jury because that's not what he was saying. He was saying, if you think he's morally guilty for driving away, this is the reason he drove away. He never said compulsion is a defense to murder. And the jury, not being instructed as to the proper way to regard flight, would be confused if they followed the judge's instructions, if they listened to the prosecutor's arguments, and if they acknowledged what the judge said when he overruled the objections. I would also like...
Is there any evidence that the defendant committed any act during what you would consider to be the offense under Dennis?
No. In our opinion, no. There is no evidence of that at all.
Let me ask you this. Isn't there some evidence, maybe you can tell me what you think of this, you can remind me where this is, but there's some evidence that the defendant, while in the car, shouted out to the shooter, come on, let's go, or I'm waiting for you, or something like that, while the shooting was still occurring, while the shooter was running away and firing back at the car. Now, you'd have to say at least that while the shooter's running away and firing back at the car, that's during the offense, would you?
Well, it depends whether the victim was killed before or after
We don't really know that, do we?
We don't, and that's why...
The jury could reasonably, based on the evidence, conclude that force that was being used, that shooting, which accomplished the killing, was still going on as the shooter ran away from the car. Now, what do you make of the evidence that the defendant was exhorting the shooter, come on, I'm not going to wait for you forever? Is that some type of encouragement during the crime? Is that some type of backup? What is that?
Your Honor, it is extraordinarily ambiguous, and that's why there's a reasonable doubt as to his guilt, because we don't know if the victim was dead. We don't know at what point in the shooting that occurred. We don't know what his intention was in saying, come on, get in, or I'll leave you behind. So, therefore, we don't think it's proof beyond reasonable doubt, and certainly indicates a closely balanced case, if that's what the state is going on. I would also like to comment on the Clayton Sims cross-examination, if I may, and some of the errors which flow out of that, because I think these are extremely serious. Clayton Sims...
You know, you're running out of time, and you know, I think you want to comment on what's happened in the closing arguments instead of that.
Absolutely. Well, the closing arguments included things such as saying finding not guilty would be a mockery, that the first jury would be sick to their stomach if they knew what had happened, that this would be a trend, let's not make this a trend of lying, that you might as well legalize drive-by shootings. I mean, this was a free-for-all. And many of the comments were objected to, and objections were overruled. And I think the last thing I want to say, because I didn't respond in my reply brief to this, is that the prosecutor says, well, Judge Hill looked at all this, he considered this, and he said, no error. And frankly, I think that's the most disturbing thing possibly in the entire case. Because if Judge Hill had remembered, and he was reminded of this, he sustained objection to the sick to the stomach comment. So it couldn't possibly be that the prosecutors did nothing wrong. And for Judge Hill to say that all of these things, you know, he could have said something like, well, that might have been wrong, but there was no objection. That might have been wrong, but the evidence was overwhelming, etc. Instead, he made a strong point of saying these prosecutors did absolutely nothing wrong. And he implied that the bringing up these errors was amounted to making frivolous arguments or making frivolous accusations, which could damage prosecutors' careers and reputations. If the standard here is abuse of discretion, and we maintain that it's de novo, but if the standard were abuse of discretion, this was certainly abuse, because apparently he didn't even recognize what had happened in the closing argument and in the cross-examination of Clayton Sims. Particularly given how closely balanced the case was, this cannot fail to be error and cannot fail to justify reversal.
All right, why don't you save some time for rebuttal?
Thank you.
Again, good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court.
Yeah, let me ask you a question right off the bat. Is it ever okay to compare a defendant to the Nazis in Nuremberg?
He wasn't being compared to the Nazis at Nuremberg, Your Honor.
Isn't that what he said?
No, it's not what he said, I'm sorry. But he said that the defense that the defendant was asserting, the sort of compulsion or I was following orders a defense, did not work for the Nazis at Nuremberg. He wasn't saying the defendant was a Nazi. There's no comparison to the defendant's acts and the acts of the Nazis. He was not making a moral equivalence argument.
I mean, isn't it kind of dangerous to talk about a defendant in reference to Nazis?
It can be in certain instances, Your Honors.
I mean, I've never seen an instance when it wasn't.
Well, clearly, the one mention of the word Nazis was not the straw that broke this camel's back.
Is it ever okay to say to the jurors, if you don't acquit, you might as well legalize drive-by shootings in this town? I mean, is that the type of thing that the state's attorney's office is going to do, push the envelope when you don't have to?
I think when you realize that comment came after a summation of and a discussion of all the evidence in the case, which was not.
Yeah, but my question is it ever okay to do that?
Yes.
Okay, you can do that.
Yes. In the context this state's attorney did that, that's okay. When he outlines the evidence and says that this is murder in this case, this is a drive-by, this is accountability. And to say something else is to urge the, you know, this is to urge the fearless administration of justice, and this kind of comment can't
properly. Was it also permissible for the prosecutor to say that Sims lied at the first trial when he didn't take the stand at the first trial?
It is permissible in the context of what the prosecutor was saying. You have to remember here that the defendant opened the door to comments about what happened at the first trial. If you'll recall, when Clayton Sims was on the stand, his lawyer asked him, did you testify at your trial? Did you plead not guilty? Did you go to trial? Were you found not guilty? And frankly, it's very obvious what Clayton Sims was doing here. He had no jeopardy attached. He had no repercussions that could ever attach to him. He went to a lawyer, found out, you know, I can say basically anything I want. I can go in there and they can't do anything to me. Is that correct?
Yeah, but yes, my question is all these comments, I mean, was it permissible to tell the jury that there was no bystander that the state knew of when the state called a bystander at the first trial? Isn't that a lie?
No, because what he's saying, that no bystander that could give us any light as to what the defendant was thinking. If we recall, that bystander said, I don't know who was driving the car. I went and ran and hid in the back. And when I came back, not only the shooter, but the car was gone. So there was no bystander who could tell this jury anything that was in the mind of the defendant, because he didn't even say the defendant was there. So no, there is no bystander. Because the defendant's defense really wasn't, I wasn't there. His defense was, what I did didn't constitute murder. So no, that bystander could not have helped. And that was a correct statement given these facts. Turning to what the evidence is in this case, Your Honor.
So the prosecution could do no wrong no matter what they say.
I didn't say that, Your Honor. There was a comment that the objection was sustained and therefore cured. The other comments, the vast majority of comments, as we detailed point by point in our brief, were not objected to, were not in the post-trial motion. They are therefore waived. Again, putting this case into context, Your Honor.
I mean, taking all these things together, you feel that this defendant received a fair trial?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Absolutely.
In America or where?
Absolutely, in Cook County, here in
America. In Cook County?
Yes, sir.
And that's still in America?
Yeah, I believe so, yes.
All right.
And this defendant did, in fact, receive a fair trial. This defendant was, in fact, guilty of murder. There was certainly more evidence than defense counsel would have you believe today. This defendant knew there was a gun in the back seat. He said to Rufus Johnson that he knew that Clayton had a gun or unit on him. He knew that he was strapped with a gun. When he's later describing what happened to Rufus Johnson, he uses the word we busted a move. We clearly indicating that he knew what was going on. We have evidence from Nolan Swain that says that the shooter yelled, "That's the guy who shot me. Chase him." So there's this chase that comes by. He cuts off the victim's car. He waits while the co-defendant gets out of the car, starts shooting. The co-defendant, when he took the stand, would have you believe that this was one pull of the trigger at one place. All the bullets came out. But it's clear from the physical evidence that the shooting continued at two places. It continued down the block. As they're continuing down the block, the defendant yells to the, during the course of this shooting, yells to the co-defendant, come on, get in the car. Clearly, this is not Phillips. In Phillips, there's no evidence, according to the court, that the defendant knew that the co-defendant had a gun. There is evidence in this case that the defendant knew the co-defendant had a gun. There is evidence in this case the defendant knew that they were going to commit a crime. Defendant tells the police. Though another thing counsel didn't point out is the fact that the defendant makes statements to the police. He places himself there. He places himself in the car. He says that I told the co-defendant to hurry up and come on, get in the car. He also says he knew that
What do you think the significance of that is? Hurry up and come on, get in the car.
Well, I mean, a jury is perfectly capable of seeing that the defendant intended to drive him away from the scene, that this was, you know, he knew that maybe the police were coming. He had seen him shoot. He didn't disavow the action. He didn't drive away. He didn't say, oh, my God, I didn't know this guy was going to get out and shoot somebody. He lets him get back in the car. And the notion that...
I understand that this question is in a vacuum, but hurry up and get in the car. Is that something that occurs during the commission of the offense? Or do you have to take
it? It might be. It can be. But I don't think we even need to have just that, as you mentioned. It's not in a vacuum, because we do know that the defendant knew there was a gun in the car. So it's another piece. And I just look at the Reed case, and the Illinois Supreme Court talks about the things that you can consider when discussing legal responsibility. His presence during the commission of the offense, he admits that. His failure to prevent the incident from occurring, he doesn't prevent it from occurring. He provides the car there and the car away. Flight from the scene, failure to report the incident to the police, and any attempt to conceal weapons. We have all of those factors from People versus Reed in this case. And that's why this whole discussion of the jury instruction that wasn't given is actually beside the point. First of all, as Your Honor's pointed out, this is not the same trial as the first trial. This jury did not send out a note saying we're confused. The standard accountability jury instruction was given here. That's proper. There's nothing improper about that jury instruction. And in fact, if you look at the proposed instructions the defendant wanted, he wanted a romance Dennis, but that's really about the felony murder escape rule. That's really not about accountability. And the discussion in romance Dennis talks about the difference between those two scenarios and explains basically that what the instruction that they wanted was really the felony murder escape rule, and romance Dennis makes that clear. The other thing to remember is that the statement that the instruction that they wanted was part of the law, but not all the law. It didn't include those things that I discussed here in People versus Reed. And those are circumstantial pieces of evidence that were present in this case that show that the defendant was accountable for this crime. And if you wanted to give another instruction, had the jury asked, you would have had to give the whole law. You couldn't just give little pieces of the law, and that would have actually been more confusing. But the bottom line is, in this case, of course, the jury did not send out any notes and did not express any confusion whatsoever. For the reasons that we've stated here today and the reasons that we've stated in the brief, we'd ask that Your Honors affirm the defendant's conviction.
Just want to ask you a fact question. I want to make sure. The statement, that's the guy who shot me, was that made prior to the shooting, or was that? Isn't there some evidence that was made after the shooting as well?
There's evidence that it was both, but the statement by Nolan Swain in the car, that's the guy that shot me, and then they chase the thing. Then afterwards, there was also a statement about, he shot me a couple months ago. But
that guy shot me, he didn't care about me.
I don't care about him. He didn't care about me. The defendant admits to the police that he knew that the co-defendant had been shot by a guy named B, but he thought it was a different guy named B, and so that he was surprised when the co-defendant shot the actual victim, who was named B, his nickname. He had a B tattoo on his arm. So there certainly was evidence that the defendant, even in the statement of Nolan Swain, he talks about driving recklessly. They pull a U-turn on the street. They chase the guy down several streets. They cut him off. So clearly this is an attempt to chase someone. And the defendant himself says to the police that he thought at one point, this is going to be cool because I'm going to get a new set of rims or something, because he thought they were going to do a carjacking. Well, even if that's his thought, that is still accountability for this murder, because under the common design, under the Terry rule, he doesn't have to intend that the murder take place. But, of course, he knew there was a gun. And so the facts in this case are not Phillips. They're more like the Taylor case that we cited in our brief. And in that case, the defendant wasn't even the driver. He was a passenger in the back seat. So the evidence actually is very strong in this case, and it is more than just the recanted statements and the 11510 prior inconsistent statements, admitted substantive evidence. It's also the defendant's own statements, where he places himself there, places himself with knowledge. He won't admit to knowing there's a gun, but he certainly told Rufus Johnson that he knew there was a gun. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher.
But
Your Honor, just so that there's no confusion as to some of the facts, I was just looking over pages 13, 14, and 15 of the prosecution's brief, where they ably summarize what the defendant told Winstead. One of the things he told Winstead was that Quentin had said he wanted to go buy marijuana, and he did not tell Winstead he knew there was a gun. He did say earlier he knew that that Sims had picked up a gun and then he thought he had given it to his cousin. And according to what he told Winstead, the first time he knows there's a gun is when it's pulled out. And all, what he also says to Winstead is when he turned the car, it was because Sims said, I want to holler at that guy, which could mean anything. Like, I want to buy marijuana, I want to talk to him, who knows? So, again, the evidence at best was closely balanced. Now, I'd like just to respond to some of the things the some of the things my opponent said about the closing argument. First of all, it is not true that most of these comments were not objected to. The reverse is true. The only comment I can find where we have to raise plain error is the comment about drive-by shootings, where there is no objection. But the sick to the stomach argument, there was an objection sustained, but the point is the prosecutor continued along the same lines, exactly the same lines, and his closing statement was, he's duped one jury, let's not make that a trend. And that was bad on two grounds. One, the idea that not taking the stand and putting the state to this proof is duping, which is an extremely prejudicial remark, but second, that you should convict, not because of the facts and law here, but to redress what happened with Clayton Sims in his first trial. That was very bad. Everything else, the Nazis remark, objection overruled. Mockery remark, objection overruled. As to many of the things that Clayton Sims was cross-examined about, there was no objection, but there was a key objection to the business about getting up and stand, on the stand, letting your lawyer say you were not guilty, as if this was some sort of great injustice. In closing, I'd just like to say what I was saying at the beginning. Anthony Johnson is not entitled to a perfect trial. Nobody is. Everybody's entitled to have a fair trial. And two trials, both less than fair, are not the one fair trial he's entitled to. So just on the assumption that your honors do not acquit him and find him not guilty beyond reasonable doubt, which we urge, you should definitely grant him a new trial. Thank you.
We'll take this case under advisement. The court is adjourned.
Thank you, counsel.